Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
To navigate some of these steep hills that we have, and it's just not there at all. I mean, it's barely there right now to the standards that Napa Valley farmers want on the valley floor, let alone what we can do up here on the hillside. So right now, we're always looking to the Mosel. The Mosel is in Germany, who's sort of blazing the trail for very, very steep and rugged environments with mechanized parts to your farming. So it's exciting. That's the future, is mechanization. We're going to be at a point where we're relying on hand labor for very few parts of our farming. You know, I think the very last thing that'll probably be fully mechanized in Napa is the actual harvesting of the fruit. That'll probably be the last thing that you keep as hand, but the suckering, the pruning, the greening, the thinning, all that stuff is as fast as possible is to get that mechanized. So labor and environment are probably one and two.
Mm-hmm.
And then closely followed by that would be the collapse of the three-tier distribution model and how that's going to force us to have to refocus where our strengths lie, which is probably here, California in general, and then probably have to retreat from a few states that just aren't worth the time anymore. You know, but that's 20 years. That's 20, 25 years out kind of thing. So yeah, labor, environment, distribution, probably number one issues.
So speaking of distribution, you obviously have a very strong relationship with your consumers. You've had the long-term aspect of it when you've had fans of the brand, you know, 20, 30 years ago, I'd assume. Are they still actively involved?
Yeah, we've got a pretty sticky wine club and we've designed it with that in mind, is to be able to keep people around for decades if possible. The contemporary way that people seem to approach wine clubs now is to keep a nice little rotation, and they don't really stick around with one wine club for a long time. They keep this nice little rotation going. So we designed our wine club, our entry level wine club, to be as approachable as possible. It's only two shipments a year, four bottles each. That's eight bottles total per year. So it's quite the opposite from your pretty standard wine club, which is, you know, they're jamming, you know, cases of Cabernet down your throat every couple of months, and it's just overwhelming and very expensive, and not a lot of people can literally just can't drink that much wine.
Yeah.
And when you're a winery that only does Cabernet and maybe does a Sauv Blanc, it's just a lot of the same thing over and over again. So not only are you getting a pretty reasonable amount of juice for that entry-level club, but you're also getting, you know, Syrahs, Zins, Francs, Chardonnays, Cabs, Merlots, just a whole disparate amount of SKUs that, you know, you don't get tired of one thing. So yeah, to answer your question, we got a lot of loyalty, and we're lucky to have it, and that's the best part about this business and the most edifying part of this business is creating something of value that people keep coming back for.
Yeah.
That's what keeps us doing it. So yeah, we've got club members that have been with us since... Yeah, we first started the club probably in 94, 93. So we've still got some first pagers that have been with us since day one. Not a lot of them, but there's still some in there. So
that's really cool. So in terms of your demographics, the majority of your members in California, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
By far. Yeah.
And
we do 50% of our sales exist here in California. That's a big for us.
There's a huge concern on the part of smaller wineries about attrition, of course, and also acquiring new customers.
Yeah.
Particularly, much conversation is centered around the millennial group. And I know technically you're not that, but you're pretty darn close.
I'm in there.
Yeah.
I'm in that cohort.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on that whole thing?
I'm not worried about the millennials right now, that they're not buying a ton of Napa. I just don't know that a lot of them can afford it. You know, they're worried about buying a house and being able to afford a place to live. Most of our drinkers have always been people in their 40s and above. So it's just, I mean, that's not, they're not in the wheelhouse right now. And there is some fervor and some panic. It's like, oh, these guys aren't drinking Napa. What are we going to do? It's like, some millennials are still in their 20s. Like, they can't afford Napa. They're not interested in it at this point in their lives. They're not married. They're not coming up here on little romantic getaways. It's not what they do yet.
Yeah.
So I'm not totally worried about it. But again, if we had 200,000 cases of Napa Cab to do something with, I'd be much more panicked. But we get to pick and choose where we sell our wines because they're so specialized. It's not a lot of stuff looming over us that we need to move. So yeah, if I had 200,000 cases of inventory, I'd be looking at every single age cohort and wondering why they weren't drinking my wine.
Do you think that there's a conversation that needs to be happening, not just with millennials, but just conversation with the people that even have remote interest in wine, let alone active, to make sure that we have a dialogue?
Yeah. I'm pretty confident that my generation is pretty fluent in the basics of wine. I mean, I don't know that there's ever been a higher concentration of young sommeliers in any other generation than mine. Is the proliferation of these professional educators, if you will, mm-hmm. essentially, is really encouraging. What mm-hmm. the Guild has been doing, what WSET's been doing, is churning out people that, you know, have their head on their shoulders and have a decent understanding of what's going on with wine and the general, the world of alcohol is great. And yeah. I think that just raises the general understanding and general knowledge base of everybody just by having them out in the aggregate, spreading the good word of wine. And then, you know, of course, any restaurant that can afford it has a sommelier and staff that just desperately wants to talk your ear off. given the chance. So the level of interest that I see on the professional side, especially on the service side, is really encouraging. Mm-hmm. As far as outlets for people to educate themselves and get the information they need, they don't always have to come to the source. They don't mm-hmm. always have to come to Bordeaux or Napa or Tuscany. They can go to their local restaurant that usually will have a wine buyer there that's happy to talk to you about what's going on. And the Guild and WSET and the Master of Wine programs, I mean, they've never turned out more people than they have now as far as just basic education. I think it's great.
Do you have any concerns about kind of their point of view? Because sometimes it can be pretty esoteric, pretty specialized.
Yeah. That can occasionally be frustrating, especially for, you know, coming from Napa where you're making, you know, the varietals that are pretty front and center and they're pretty mm-hmm. common.
Yep.
But at the same time, if I was a producer of something super esoteric, I'm probably saying the same exact thing, except the opposite, which is I'm so sick and tired of Cabernet everywhere. Why is no one drinking my Rebbiola Gaiola? Like, this is crazy. And so every now and then you'll get a crazy sommelier that wants to have a wine list that no one else in the world possibly has. And that's when you're going to drink your Zeno Movro and your other weird stuff, which is cool. I think it's good. I think it's good. I mean, every now and then you'll get this weird consensus opinion that sort of crops up. That's weird and frustrating. But then you'll get a whole bunch of other sommeliers they like to contradict each other a lot and argue and fight. So when you seemingly have one consensus in the somm community about what's good and what's not, you'll immediately have some other sort of sect of that community crop up with the opposite opinion, and they'll balance each other out. And that's kind of the nature of things. But I think they all universally hate California Chardonnay.
That's true. I've observed that too. That's definitely a unifying thread.
Yeah.
What do you think from the consumer's perspective are the best steps to try to educate themselves and participate? What would you suggest to someone that maybe, you know, is not able to come up here? If you're in California and certainly in the Bay Area, there's no excuse not to arrange a visit. This really is a beautiful property. But for people that don't have access.
The first thing everyone always says, and it's much always harder, easier said than done, but start a tasting group or join one.
Yeah.
I know people that don't have a connection to the wine world are like, well, where do I go to find that? And it's like, I have no idea. Where do you live? Like, make a Craigslist ad. I have no idea how people find these things. Go to your local wine bar. Talk loudly. Hopefully someone overhears you. So start a tasting group or join a tasting group is probably the number one way to do it. Because especially if it's not people you know, you're going to someone's house, you're meeting them at a bar, you're meeting these people you don't know, and then you're going to be forced to perform in front of them and talk about these wines in an analytical way that a lot of people are pretty uncomfortable with, especially at first. Talking about something like wine, which is so subjective, makes people really uncomfortable. And if you're not good in front of people, even in the best of circumstances, it's going to be tough for you to talk about wine in this context. So you learn really quickly as a result of that. You are listening intently to others because, especially in the beginning, you're going to be kind of taking things other people are saying and just kind of repackaging them. And you kind of just do that until you create your own base and lexicon and be able to start applying those things organically to what you're drinking on your own. So tasting groups, big for that. And what was the other thing I was going to say that is helpful? If you have the money, take the Guild Level 1.
Hmm.
get, yeah, so you wouldn't become a sommelier, although plenty of people say they're sommeliers when they get the level one, which is fine. yeah, take the level one. It's just a base. It's, last I checked, it's 2 days, 1 day with full instruction, 7 hours of instruction from some really talented sommeliers in like a sort of a panel slideshow, presentation. And then the next day is, it's a multiple choice test. It's somewhat straightforward and pretty easy. There's a pretty high pass rate. It's like 70%. Because they want to get you in there. They want to get you that level one so you can get in with your feet, you know, on solid ground and build your confidence. So level one guild from the guild's test would be a great way to get you going too. And those are easy to find just from their website on the map. They'll show you where the next one is. They're not cheap. I think it's upwards of $500 for the level one, as I think somewhere around there. So it's not cheap, but yeah, if you have the time and the desire, that's a really great way, especially because you spend a lot of that time, especially during the breaks, you spend just networking, talking with people that are there, like-minded folks, and there's where you can find your tasting group. So yeah, those would be number one and two right off the top of my head.
If you can't get to wine country. Just kind of taking a more general approach to the whole world of wine. Was so invested in it, was so enamored. But for an average person, why should they care about wine?
Why should they care about wine? That's a good question. Well, there's probably more if you really had your priorities in a row, you probably shouldn't care about wine. None of us should. but that's usually not the way people's lives work out. So why you should focus on wine? Well, I think the holy trinity that I should lead anyone to wine, I think just naturally, is if you like travel and if you like food and if you like people.
Okay.
Right in the middle of everything there is what can hold all that together and enhance every part of all three of those things is wine. Drinking in general, of course, but in this case, wine for sure enhances travel. Because you can travel for wine, obviously you travel for food and you're traveling with people. So I have a lot of friends that are into those three things and yet it hasn't clicked with wine quite yet. And it is somewhat of a source of frustration, not least of which because I just want more friends to drink with and geek out about wine that aren't in the wine industry. I want some of those old friends from the old world that I grew up with, you know, where wine has to be something that they find on their own. I'm still waiting for those moments. But yeah, I think that's the key. If you like food and travel and people, but you also don't really need to like people. You can get away with just the food and the travel part, and you can, with just those two, you fall in love with wine so quickly.
That seems like an easy formula to follow.
Yeah.
Most people do like travel. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, wine is a great companion. So just that together works quite well.
Yeah. And every bottle is it can be a fun intellectual exercise every time you open a bottle. It's not like, you know, if you're, I love gin. I'm a big gin guy as well, but for the most part, all of my gin and tonics taste the same, essentially. And it's not something I'm thinking a lot about. After I make the gin and tonic, I'm drinking the gin and tonic, I'm done with the gin and tonic. With wine, there's so much prelude before you even open the bottle. The consideration of, well, how has this been stored? When did I buy this? Who did I buy it with? Who did I intend to drink this with? Where is it from? Who made it? And why? And all of these things. And then you finally open the bottle. How's it smelling? Is it actually good? Should we decant this? How it progresses over the next 3, 4, 5, 6 hours, depending on when and how you're drinking it. Every moment of that is sort of new and fresh and exciting. I think there's no other product like it that brings all that excitement every time you open a bottle. So if you get to that level of interest, wine is self-sustaining interest. It just becomes more and more interesting. The more you understand about geography and weather and enology and viticulture, it just becomes more and more interesting every bottle you open. And at the same time, becomes much more discouraging every time you see a bad wine. It just really bums you out.
So do you practice one of those tenets? Do you travel quite a bit?
All the time. So I'm probably out of the, I'm other than my dad, I'm the only traveling salesperson in the business. So I cover a lot of the Eastern Seaboard, the Pac Northwest, Chicago, Kentucky, those kind of things. Yeah.
How about internationally? Have you been?
Yeah, I do. I was in Excuse me. I was in Hong Kong and then spent a good deal of time in Japan through pretty much all of January.
Very cool.
We exist right now. We're with Altaya Group in Hong Kong, which is a business run by... if you're in Hong Kong and you're in the wine business, you know this name. It's a guy named Paolo Pong, who comes from a pretty successful family in the steel business. But he, I think at one point he was sent here to study engineering at MIT. And someone made the mistake of giving him a bottle of Bordeaux at some point, and that was it. He was no longer interested in getting the family business, and wine became his obsession. I think he's been called one of the largest traders of first growth Burgundy or Grand Cru Burgundy in the world over in Hong Kong. And we're one of two Napa brands that he has in his book. Everything else he does is with DRC and Burgundy stuff. So it's us and Fisher, which is also right up the hill.
Wow, that's quite a comment right there.
Yeah, it was awesome. I don't know how he ran into my dad many years ago, but they hit it off, and we've been doing a little bit of business over there in Hong Kong pretty consistently, which is in a fascinating market. And Asia in general, I mistakenly assumed Napa had a stronger foothold in Asia than it does. It is almost non-existent. We are totally, we're of course overshadowed by France. Whole area of the world was raised on French wines. Hong Kong is no exception. And then not right behind France, because they dominate by a large margin, but far below France, then you have Australia and Chile, and then way, way, way below Chile and Australia, you have Napa.
Shouldn't we do something about that?
We should, and there are a lot of people working on it, but we have a ton of things that are totally out of our control that are working against us, namely tariffs and excise taxing and no free trade agreements with a lot of Asian countries, Japan and Hong Kong. It's just devastating when you've got... Not only do Chile and Australia have great trade agreements with these countries, but they also, obviously, wine is much more of a national industry for them. So they have all sorts of trade groups and assistance from the government that also help them get over into these markets with better pricing, better margins, that make them more appealing. So we have a lot more headwind when it comes to coming over there with competitive pricing and stuff like that. And unfortunately... there's still kind of a stigma, depending on where you are in parts of Asia, as far as how California quality is perceived. Unfortunately, because a lot of the wine that has consistently made its way to Japan and Hong Kong and parts of Asia is the mass-produced, awful, awful swill from California. So that's been the bulk of their experience has been some shelf juice.
I think we're going to need to do something about the judgment of Hong Kong.
Yes, exactly. I'm personally more excited about Japan.
Tokyo then.
Just because Hong Kong's great, but Japan's probably my favorite country to visit. I've been a couple times in the last year, and Tokyo is just a stunning city, just from a functional standpoint, how easy it is to navigate. And everyone says this about Tokyo. This is not news to anybody, but... I went there for the first time, 2 years ago. So to me, I'm still very wide-eyed and excited about how amazing that city is. And their focus on food and food quality and just that part of Japanese culture where they're so eager to learn about other food cultures and then incorporating the wine with that. I've sensed a tremendous amount of excitement for them to learn, because there's a lot of people just don't have the basics of California wine over there. So when I was over there with a bunch of other vintners from Napa Valley, there was just so much excitement to see us over there. So I think Japan definitely has a bright future with Napa, which is cool.
Well, it sounds like it might be up to you to develop it further.
No, I mean, we have an importer now. Our wine is available over there. Now the question is, can we get it into more restaurants?
Yeah.
Can we get it into some retail? That's what's lacking. Right now it's just on a bunch of private lists that go to, executives and private mailing lists like that. So that's the start. We have some of it imports our wine. We have it sitting in a warehouse. That's the base from which we can work, and then access restaurants and then maybe pick some retail partners that we can work with. But restaurants for sure. That country does food culture right. They've just got restaurants everywhere.
Well, this is actually quite exciting, because if you could also get together some of the next gen vintners, children, just like yourself, and really establish a foothold in Japan and promote the brand of Napa as well as your own brand. Mm-hmm. I think that would be quite interesting.
Yeah, that was the overarching message that we kept getting reminded of, because we were there with the Napa Valley Vintners Association. So they have, obviously we're there to promote ourselves, but the overarching theme was to really just raise the profile of Napa in general, regardless of where you're from. And that's true. Yeah, when in doubt, just talk about Napa. You can't lose. because it'll up your profile no matter where you are in Napa. Napa is on people's minds over there.
Yeah.
So that's what people are working on, is just elevating Napa, and then we'll break it down into the constituent 17 sub-AVAs once they understand what Napa is.
Yeah.
And what we do.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing the work already, and it's just going to progress into something hopefully more substantive.
The goal is to export at least as much as it takes to justify expensing a plane ticket. To get over there at least once a year, because I love it over there. I love it so much.
So you've obviously, you know, well-traveled, and what you chose beyond the winery as far as working in a wine bar, you've tasted a ton.
Yeah.
What have been some of your epiphanies? What bottles kind of set your mind and heart afire?
Most recently, kind of a mind-blowing wine I had recently, which is like, oh yeah, of course. I had a 78 Cheval Blanc. One and only Cheval Blanc I've ever had. I was at my grandfather's house on my mom's side, so not Robert Keenan, but he's always had some good friends in San Francisco that have always, they've been huge wine guys. My grandfather's never been the biggest wine guy, but he's always been given gifts of wine that he didn't fully understand how awesome they were, and he would just kind of file them into his cellar. And so we've kind of established this informal tradition of at least going over to his house in San Francisco once a week, and if I can, have dinner with him. And I'll usually use that as an excuse to slink down to his cellar and find something to open up that we can both enjoy. So it was first round of the playoffs this year for the Warriors. I was over there watching a game with him, right against, I can't remember, was it first or second round, but I went down to the cellar as I always do, looking for something good, and I found a bottle with a red capsule. The red Bordeaux capsule looks. I grabbed it immediately to see what it was. It had no label, and the glass was all smudged. It was looking like it was in rather poor condition. And luckily, on the capsule, it said Cheval Blanc, so I could tell that this was going to be pretty badass. But I wanted to downplay it a little bit, just in case my grandfather wasn't in the mood to open up something so awesome. So, you know, I called up from the cellar, you know, "Hey, Gramps, you've got this, you know, old bottle. It's dirty. Doesn't have a label, it's looking pretty crummy, you know, we might as well just open this one too." And he's like, "Yeah, whatever, bring it up." And so we opened, no, we didn't know what year it was because it didn't say, obviously no label, and we got the cork out without any trouble at all. It was in perfect condition. And then they have the vintage right on the label, and that's when we realized it was a 78 Cheval Blanc. And it was pretty impressive. I mean, it's rare that I get a red wine like that you really people talk about minerality all the time and misapply that terminology pretty consistently, but that was one of the first red wines that it's at a certain point it smelled like you had your nose in a cup of blood. I mean, it really had that rich sort of petrichor iron copper smell to it that was just really, really savory and tasty, and it wasn't umami, it wasn't fruit driven, it wasn't sort of earth driven, it was this minerality thing. This tastes like copper. It smelled like copper blood almost. It was amazing. It was incredible. And 78's, you know, sort of a non-year for Bordeaux. It's not something that anyone loses sleep over trying to collect. So it was really cool that a wine that isn't a super collectible year was still that amazing. So that's the most recently that was really inspiring as far as what we can also pursue as a framework.
Yes.
I'm of course constantly impressed by other wines that we're not even close to being near in terms of style, but I run into Greek wines every now and then, the Xenomavros and stuff like that. Those are wines that I think are just absolutely divine.
Really?
And totally underappreciated. So let's see what else. I had a Merlot from that grew near Nagano in Japan when I was over there, so very cool climate Merlot. And it wasn't that good. But it wasn't bad either. It just was really thin and very, very austere. And it was dry, thank God. I did not expect it to be dry. But that was exciting because that got me thinking about, you know, just the pipe dream of establishing a vineyard somewhere in Japan, which, to my knowledge, has not been done on a high-end level yet, which either says one of two things: no one's done it yet, or it's just a bad idea and people have tried. But that Merlot was really interesting because it's freaking cold up there near Nagano. I mean, Winter Olympics up there. We did some snowboarding when we were there in January. So it tells me that people are doing it. People have been trying it. It's just a question of has someone gone over there to really try and apply some of the really high-end techniques that we've been doing here in an attempt to make a world-class wine? Has someone gone over there with that kind of focus? And so that Merlot got me thinking. I mean, talk about an excuse to go visit Japan consistently.
You have a vineyard
over there, that'd be great. So I think about that a lot too, is finding a place to just totally wildcat and establish for the first time.
Yeah.
Is something that has tremendous appeal. And to me, it occurs to me that I'm going to have to go out of the country for that, because, or at least out of the state, because California, I mean, it's been reconnoitered pretty thoroughly as far as its arability for viticulture.
Yeah.
So, but you've got a winery in every state of the union, including District of Columbia. So, I mean, people are trying it everywhere. It's respect to anyone who's doing it.
You touched upon something really interesting earlier when you said a touchstone. You know, when you tasted the Cheval Blanc, there's something so compelling that you got you thinking about what can be achieved within the realm of wine.
Yeah.
So you have this, you know, phenomenal canvas that you work with almost on a daily basis in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
And as you mentally prepare to take it over one day, what would be your ambition? What would you want to create here that is not necessarily like Cheval Blanc, but equally as compelling in terms of the impact that it has on somebody?
We'll see. I mean, time will tell. It's funny. I texted a buddy of mine who works for a distributor here in California, and I told him how I was almost discouraged by how amazing this wine was, and I just don't know how you do that. And he's like, all right. But once you've been farming your land for 250 years, then we'll talk. You guys are brand new in the grand scheme of things. Cheval Blanc, that land, those people know every inch of it, and they know what it does and what it can't do, and they know what to do. And you guys are still new. You guys are still figuring it out, and what the tricks you need to do and little microclimates you need to exploit and what you need to do in the cellar. So we're at a great start right now, I think. Overall, to answer your question, I want to be considered one of the best producers in Napa. I want to be in the conversation that everyone has when they talk about the best producers and the most iconic producers. And I'm pretty competitive, and my dad is too, and I don't know that I'd be happy with anything less. So I guess the question is, you know, what do we need to focus on to get there? I think the answer is probably going to be Merlot.
Really?
That's really our strength by far. Everyone makes good Cabernet here by and large to a certain degree, but Merlot is harder to come by. At the level that I think we produce it at pretty consistently, which is helpful. It's an easier way to stand out too.
Yes.
That's been our bread and butter. That's why people come up here, they're looking for Merlot. Now increasingly Cab Franc as well.
Very cool. Yeah. We've actually been sipping on the Merlot that was a huge standout for me yesterday. And yet again, I made an appearance, which is a mailbox vineyard. I was going to ask you about a bit of history of that vineyard and this particular wine.
Yeah, so the original mailbox, first vintage was in 1997 or 98.
Okay.
Just in time for Phylloxera to completely wipe it out.
Uh-huh.
And so the original block that we sourced this from was by the big mailbox bank that you guys passed on the way in from Spring Mountain. It was right there beside the road. And then when we were replanting every single thing on the property, you know, when you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to pull vines out and then replant them, you start worrying about finances. And I think the appeal of upping our Cabernet production was probably the financial concern was what tipped the balance of replanting what was originally the mailbox vineyard over to Cabernet in the late mm-hmm. 90s. So after 97, the initial vintage, this wine disappeared. My dad no longer made it. And as these things always work in the wine business, as soon as people couldn't have any more of it, it's all they were asking him for. And it actually annoyed him, kind of drove him crazy. And so he decided to reestablish the mailbox vineyard at a different site location from another block of Merlot that had always really impressed him, which is right over there where the mailbox is now, just beyond the catch pond. And so it went from 97 as the inaugural vintage, and then the second vintage was 2001. And then we took Laura's mailbox and then planted it right next to where the block began. And then for my dad's birthday, but I'm also kind of including it in this Father's Day and maybe last Christmas as well, just to get extra credit, I had a very extra large, cartoonishly large mailbox fabricated from metal and then put it on a 10-foot steel pole and then planted it right beside the original mailbox. So now we have our first piece of vineyard art, so to speak, outside, which demarcates the very beginning of the mailbox vineyard, which is this really unique single block of 4 acres in Merlot, 5 acres in Merlot, on a 30, maybe even 35 degree grade plane. So it's quite steep. It's terraced. And what's really interesting is it faces west, which is technically speaking, that's facing back into the mountain range, and then beyond that, facing the Pacific Ocean. So as far as vineyard aspect goes, it's not the aspect you would expect us to have on Spring Mountain. Because if you look at a map, you'd expect most of our exposure to be east and southern,
right?
And not facing back into the mountain. But if you were to look over there, you'll see that you keep going down that hill, you'll end up in this very, very productive river, essentially, a seasonal creek that has run through that area for thousands and thousands of years and has created lots and lots of erosion. It essentially has created this little canyon that runs its way down the mountain. And because of that clearance that canyon has created between where we planted the Merlot and then the rest of the mountain range, the Mayacamas, it has enough of that clearance where it catches all that afternoon sun as the sun is setting and going towards Sonoma and the coast. So it's a really unique little hillside aspect and a really, really lively expression of the varietal. So this is pretty much our flagship Merlot. This is what most people recognize when they think about us is the mailbox Merlot.
I was absolutely blown away by the power concentration. It's so darn delicious, but I have no doubt that it'll lay down for decades without any issues.
I mean, I was drinking 89 Merlot yesterday, like I said, and it was just, still had a lot of youth on it.
I also want to point out that I really expected a much higher price point, given what I tasted. Mm-hmm. All your price points are very gentle.
Yeah.
Which also probably ties into the conversation we had earlier about the loyalty of the consumer. You treat them very well. You give them a lot of value for the money.
Totally. We like it that way. A lot of factors involved in that. First and foremost, more importantly, is the cost basis, which we started in 74. We would not be able to afford to sell our Zinfandel at $38 and our entry-level Merlot at $44. At the volume we do, if we started 2 years ago,
it just
wouldn't be financially viable. So, our pricing is based on just the privilege of having started when we did, and then closely related to that, we're not greedy. We're not wringing every single dollar out of every bottle we can, and that second point is closely related to the third, which is when my dad took over. One of the many things he started was one of the few rules he was going to follow as far as pricing from year to year is, no matter the Parker scores, no matter the critical reception. For any of the SKUs, no SKU will increase in price from vintage to vintage more than 5%. So if you get 100 points from Parker from 97 to 98, that price is only going up a couple bucks, for instance, that kind of thing. So he's maintained that rule ever since day one. So that's why you have those prices. Again, we're mostly estate driven. We source most of the fruit we deal with is grown by us. So again, that helps the cost basis. Again, it's just... So many of these things have worked out in our favor, and we are happy to carry on that value to the consumer if it keeps them coming back.
Absolutely. So this is truly a special place, not only in terms of the view that I'm looking at. I know a lot of hard work goes into those vineyards, but boy, they're absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
And your tasting room really feels like a home.
Yeah.
So just hanging out there is so enjoyable. I'm assuming you have a hard time getting people out of here because once you come here, you just want to linger.
Yeah, there are definitely some lingerers, but that's okay. This tasting room is the perfect little synthesis of both sides of my family. So my grandfather on my mom's side, who's an architect, who's the one I had the Cheval Blanc with, he was the one who actually designed this tasting room.
Wow.
So it was actually him and my mom worked together on this. So.
Yeah, it's quite welcoming and warm.
I wish you'd seen the old one. It was quite different.
Really?
There's a wall right behind us, and that wall didn't exist. It was essentially a railing, and you could lean over the railing and just yell right down into the cellar.
Oh, wow.
So it was all one big space with a suspended platform, essentially. This was the suspended platform just over the barrels, which obviously made air conditioning in here quite difficult. So some people got a little cold when they visited. And then you had all the noise coming up from the cellar, which... changed the atmosphere. I think now we have the best of all both worlds. We've got this nice, sort of very cozy tasting room, and then you've got the cellar right below that's easily accessible for tours. But you can still not freeze your ass off when you come up here in the winter and it's cellar temperature.
And you have quite a few wines open for the consumers to taste.
Yes, we have a lot of wines. We often raise some eyebrows when we get visitors up here that have just come from, you know, some standard wineries in the Napa Valley where, you know, you go in there and you get two cabs, you know, maybe a Merlot and a Sauv Blanc at maximum. Sometimes you get less than that, and oftentimes you're paying a lot for it.
Yep.
On any given day, we'll have like 10 wines open. And our tasting fee, I think, is $30, but we may have just changed it to $40, and that's refunded with the purchase of literally anything. So I think it's pretty fair. You really can't get away with not charging for tasting fees anymore because you get too many bad faith actors showing up and taking advantage of that in the long run, which is now why people have these.
Yeah.
But I think 30 or 40, depending on what we're doing right now, for the amount of wines that we have open is a screaming deal.
Yeah. No, this is really a place where not only you get to taste a ton of terrific wines and look at the view and play with the dog.
Play with the dog if he happens to be up here.
But really, to me, it embodies a lot of what I want to experience in Napa, that spirit of hospitality.
Yeah.
And it's simple, but it's high impact. There's a lot of value here from a lot of different points of view. And I'm very grateful for that because it's, you know, there's a lot of places that do things their own way and they're worthwhile and such like that. But what you've achieved here is this fusion of history and modern pieces that somehow seamlessly play together and you feel very well taken care of.
Yeah, it's we're so lucky. There's not a day that I don't wake up here. Waking up here is a whole different thing because we've got this little layer of fog that's leaking through and heading its way down. And it's just absolutely stunning here in the morning, the way the environment is changing so dramatically as the sun is rising. So there's not a day that I don't wake up here and just feel so, so grateful that there's so much in front of me that I'm lucky to be a part of.
That's a beautiful sentiment to end on. Thank you very much for sharing your story.
Thanks
and
for coming
your
up.
Wines.
Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.